The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Dr. Tom Patolkar is a surgeon. He is based in Gaza in what is effectively the last functioning hospital there. And he joins me now on the show. Tom, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. I realise the amount of pressure you must be under. Can you share with us where exactly you are in Gaza and what the situation is like?
So I'm in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, which is a big city in the southern half of Gaza. This is one of the few semi-functional hospitals left in the south. It is full of patients, many, many whom the vast majority have got injuries as a result of the constant bombardment. There's much of the city, the vast majority has seen extensive damage. There's many, many buildings completely destroyed. There's drones overhead constantly and bombardment every day that varies in intensity from one every few minutes to one every hour or so. And a lot of people around in the hospital, all looking very malnourished, very hungry, and with very, very little food available either in the hospital or outside the hospital.
You describe the hospital as one of the semi-functional hospitals in Gaza. What does semi-functional mean in practical terms? What medical resources have you at your disposal?
So we still have some, but there's a significant lack in many things. Just even the types of dressings we use are now more limited. Even simple things like just some of the fluids, some of the drugs that are used are getting very low on stock. Some of the surgical equipment that is needed to treat these cases is getting very low on stock. The overwhelming number of patients, many of whom arrive in sort of mass casualty scenarios when a whole host of patients come in at the same time. So yes, we're still able to treat patients and the theatres are still running at the moment, but by no means up to the standard that we would like to be treating them under more normal circumstances.
And those mass casualty events, how are you alerted to them? What I'm asking there is, in a normal situation, you know, you kind of, there might be an accident somewhere in a motorway and a radio operator might tell you about it, an ambulance would be on the way. I assume you guys experience the reality of maybe an explosion, a bomb being dropped, and you know something is coming.
Yeah, it is pretty much like that. You know, you hear explosions all the time, but it tends to be when you hear them a bit closer, but then not long afterwards, there'll be the sound of sirens and, you know, the casualty will fill up rapidly with patients and with relatives and family, etc., as well. And then obviously that, you know, that's a number of cases to deal with at once, often with, say, very significant injuries. Now, there's just a big explosion now. You probably didn't hear it. But, you know, as a result of that, yes, it's quite possibly in 5 minutes there'll be ambulances arriving here.
Well, listen, it goes without saying, if that happens and you need to do your duty, we will understand. But we'll keep going until that happens. Yeah. You mentioned kind of malnourishment as well. There's been a lot of focus on that in recent weeks as well, with these aid convoys parked up outside the border and very few being let in, if any. How much have you seen that in terms of your overall workload increase in recent times?
Well, it has a massive impact. I mean, it has a massive impact because the patients just really struggle to heal these horrific wounds because they're malnourished. Their immune system is repressed, so there's, you know, much more risk of infection. And then also the staff, you know, who are treating the local staff who are treating them, and to an extent the international staff, because we have very little food as well. But obviously for us it's only for a month, not for, you know, the months and months it's been going on. But they, you know, they're very, very tired. They're extremely worn out as well. And then, of course, for others, it's just a more obvious danger in that they try to get food. And as we've seen with this debacle of the you know, this group trying to distribute aid that has ended up with people getting shot and killed whilst they're trying to actually get food. And, you know, when people are desperate, anyone who's has experience of a significant humanitarian crisis where people are desperate and starving would know that that is what happens. You know, people don't queue up in a nice line and say, yes, thank you very much. You know, people are completely desperate. They're seeing their, you know, their kids starving in front of them. They will do anything to try and get food. So it's, you know, and the mechanisms do exist and have been proven to have worked over the last, you know, up until the blockade, when the UN and other professional organizations were distributing the food, and, you know, it was working well. And that's the system that needs to be reinstigated.
Yeah, because you had a first-hand experience then of seeing that system work. The pushback from the Israelis and the IDF is, we can't let that aid in because, you know, Hamas take it and they don't distribute it, or they distribute it for their own gain. Your experience of how that worked was that it worked well and it got to the places it needed, was it?
Absolutely, yeah. And I don't think there's any, well, I certainly haven't seen any evidence, and the UN have certainly said quite vociferously that, you know, the program beforehand was working extremely well and there was very little of the supplies disappearing here, there, or everywhere. So I think this is just more, you know, more of the sort of tales we're hearing that have very little truth behind them.
How are you coping with it all, Tom? How are you and your fellow workers there coping with it?
We're okay. I mean, you know, we're tired, we're exhausted, we're doing 14-hour days and with very little food. But as I say, it's for us, it's, you know, it's a one-month period. It's manageable. It's very unpleasant to see what is happening here, to see that, particularly with the children. I mean, I have the vast majority, I'd say 80% of the patients I'm treating are women and children with devastating, life-changing injuries. And that is, you know, that is horrible to see. And on top of that, to sense the desperation in the Palestinian people after everything they've been through, and the utter kind of pusillanimous response of world leadership across the globe that are just doing nothing.
Why is it so many women and children that you're treating?
That's a very good question. I mean, because they're the ones getting injured. You know, the patients all come to these hospitals and the majority of them are women and children. Mm. You know, that's a very good question. Yeah. Why?
So you touched on it there. I mean, how would you describe the international response to what's happening?
Non-existent. I mean, I think that I think the citizens of the world are very much showing their indignation, their disgust at what is happening here. But that's not translating. You know, we've seen, you know, a trade delegation coming from the UK to Israel this week. We've seen, I mean, when you hear, there was an interview that I saw this morning on the phone or whatever with, you know, where the Israeli ambassador to the UK said that children being killed was irrelevant. And what do governments around the world think that's acceptable? Because they're clearly doing nothing about it.
How did you feel when you heard that? Given you've seen them die in front of you.
Yeah, absolutely disgusted.
Do you suspect we're going to look back, and I think I know the answer to this, but do you suspect we'll look back and we'll think about what's happening now in the same way we think about, I don't know, Srebrenica, Cambodia, these awful kind of, you know, Rwanda as well in the mid-90s, how would I describe them? These stains kind of on kind of human history or early modern history?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we will be. And, you know, as everything with time, you know, people will look back, they'll look at the facts, They'll look at the inaction. They'll look at the opportunities that were there to stop this, and they will question it. And they will say, you know, what is wrong with humanity? How many times have we said this must never happen again?
And for you then, what you're out there for a month at the moment. How long have you been out there in this particular stint?
3.5 weeks now.
So you only have a few days left?
Yeah.
Like, what does that feel like when you've got a few days left? I assume, like, I don't know, you tell me. Is it a mixture of relief? Is it guilt? What is it?
Bit of both, to be honest. I mean, yes, worn out and drained from just seeing so much utterly unnecessary suffering, worn out and existentially wounded from the inaction of the rest of the world who are allowing this to happen. I'm talking about the global political citizenship, leadership, not the citizens. But also, yes, guilt that, you know, to leave and know that this is carrying on. And, you know, I was here right at the beginning for 6 weeks or so back in October 23. And my colleagues here, those who are still alive, I've lost quite a few, who are still here, you know, have had it constantly. And yeah, so you do feel a bit guilty about leaving, knowing that what you're leaving behind is absolutely appalling.
I mean, had I spoken to you when you were leaving then, you know, 6 weeks after the beginning of all of this in October 22 or 23, your kind of, I don't know, your prognosis for how long it all might last might not have suggested we'd still be talking to you in May, nearly June 2025. What's, because you must talk about it, or maybe you don't talk about it for very good reasons, but if you do talk about it, what's the sense amongst your colleagues there about where all this goes, about how long it will be necessary for you to come in for month-long stints to treat the women and children of Gaza being blown to bits?
Well, even if it stopped tomorrow, it would be years, because the whole health infrastructure has been completely devastated. And, you know, we talk a lot about the number of wounded, which is, you know, officially somewhere around 54,000, but highly likely to be higher. Sorry, the number killed. Mm. The number wounded is, you know, well over 100,000. And many of these have got, you know, incredibly complex injuries that are going to require multiple procedures and a very long rehabilitation period. So if it stopped tomorrow, we'd still be dealing with the consequences for years to come.
And I assume, Tom, there's people, and it's impossible to quantify this, but I assume there's also then people dying day in, day out of preventable disease or illness.
Absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, all the things that we forget about, because clearly, you know, we think of the main thing, which is the bombs and the wounded, but there's everything else. There's children not getting educated. There's people who are unable to get renal dialysis who are dying, people who can't get treatment for their cancer who are dying, people who've got diabetes who haven't got any drugs to treat their diabetes, people, children, neonates who aren't getting screened for preventable diseases. You know, there's so many other effects of this, you know, in addition to just those that have been killed and wounded.
Well, listen, Tom, I said it at the start, I'll say it again, though, we do really appreciate your time, because we all know how much pressure you're under, and you mentioned hearing an explosion and the possibility of sirens looming. So we will let you back to it, and we wish you well for the last few days, and we hope you get home safely as well. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.